Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.
All right. Joining me from the edge of the kingdom, Grant Newsham. Where are you today, Grant, tonight?
I'm in Tomorrowland. I'm headed over to the Jungle Boat ride shortly.
So he's at Disneyland. He's in Tomorrowland, and he joins us. Well, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. The you had a first of all, I was musing how when did you first start? Can you still hear me? We have a questionable connection, Grant.
Okay, I can hear you. Okay, I can hear you now.
Right, no, renegotiate it. So when did you first, when and why did you first begin working with the Japanese self-defense forces?
I lived in Japan from about 1993 onwards. And during that time, I was the... most of it, I was the associated with Marine Forces Pacific, particularly the G5. And around 96, 97, I started to get involved with the Japanese military. And I just kept doing it ever since. So I was frequently dealing with them over the years. And, you know, one of the aspects of this was that pretty much since 1945, the Marines had paid almost no attention to the Japanese army or the Japanese military because, well, you can guess why. They just weren't interested. And then around the late 90s, somehow the Marines woke up. There's a story to that, of course. And they set out to establish a relationship with the Japanese military and vice versa. And it happened to be with the Ground Self-Defense Force, though the Japanese Navy had earlier made an offer to set up a counterpart relationship. So just, you know, based on that, I just was just doing all sorts of things with them over the years. And in after the when the earthquake tsunami hit, I was called to active duty the next day. And just stayed on active duty for about 3 years. And since I didn't really have any instructions, which was what you wanted, we did got them an amphibious force, which was thought to be impossible. So you never know. Especially for someone like of our ages, you know, to think that you would spend so much time with the Japanese military and, you know, as friends is really quite something to think about.
So you that's how you get down. You start headed down that road, and slowly but surely, right, you're the kid doing country music when nobody else is really doing it, and then kind of we pivot to the Pacific, and you've been out there low for close to 25 years. Yes.
Yeah, it's stretching out. Yeah.
All right. I just thought, you know, a little bit of background. In those 20, let's talk broad lens stuff. In those 25 years, what has been what stands out the most as the greatest change over the course of the 25 years?
I think the Japanese public and even the ruling class has come around to the idea that they might have to fight. Not everyone, but it used to be it was taboo to say that. It was unthinkable. And probably by around 2012, 2013, that really started to shift. And now there is much more of an awareness that Japan faces real threats and needs to fight, but they're not doing what they need to do to be able to fight. But there is an awareness. Just one example that when we started the I and some Japanese co-conspirators and one Marine Major Marfor Pak, we started the effort. You had to keep it secret. You could not say publicly that we had an amphibious capability in mind. That was simply taboo. And if any Japanese officer had said that, he would have been cashiered or fired, and some were. And in the public, you couldn't even say it. And within a short while, it's like, what's the big deal? Of course we're going to have this. It really, when you think about it, when I was put on active duty as nominally as the Marine liaison officer to the Ground Self-Defense Force, the Japanese military, they asked us, they said, please don't tell anyone because this is so sensitive. You know, there'll be protesters and this and that. And we, of course, did tell people, but the, and there were no protests. That was the amazing thing. Just ho-hum. Like a lot of things people are really afraid of, there's not a whole lot of reason. But we also went about it the right way. It's in that sense, it's been a huge change. And I'd say the memory of World War II and that experience, which was like a lot worse for the Japanese than it was for us, unless you were one of them. But, speaking in a general sense,
right.
That's long gone. That really doesn't feature anymore. And younger Japanese now will often, if they even know about World War II, because it is taught in a very strange way, to the extent it's taught at all in Japanese schools, they would tend to see, if asked, should Japan have a military and defend itself? They'd go, yeah. There's a Japanese expression called atarimae, which means it's like saying, well, yeah. That's kind of how it translates, and that would be their response. So that, like with us, that generation that remembers or knows people directly who were involved in that era, it's shrinking, and it's changing the way public attitudes are in Japan. The big problem they, of course, have is that the Chinese have gone on this military buildup so fast and so widely that the Japanese would have had a hard time keeping up, even if they had tried to keep up, which they really haven't. So that's just a couple of comments. It's an interesting topic, though, because Japan certainly has changed in the last 30 years or so.
How do you see, let's look forward, and how do you see, what do you see the biggest challenge? And I know China obviously looms out there like the fog over Gotham City. But what's the biggest challenge for the next 25 years?
See, maintaining some sort of autonomy and independence against China. We always talk about the PRC as this as a threat. But it is. The Chinese are on record as saying they are going to teach the Japanese a lesson, and when the time is right, and they have felt like they could do it any time, and from about 3 or 4 years ago, but the presence of the Americans is really what slows them down.
Got it.
But that really, you cannot understate the threat that Japan faces. And it isn't necessarily that you're going to have the People's Liberation Army landing in Honshu and driving up to Tokyo, but rather you take some little bit of property down in the south in the Ryukyus, or you sink some Japanese fishing boats or Japanese ships, and then you make it clear that, we're the boss and you're going to do what we tell you. It's the sort of dominance, say, that the Russians had over Finland would be about as charitable as you could possibly put it.
Got it.
And that is the threat that they face. It's more serious than their shrinking population, than their big national debt. It really is. It's one of these epical challenges that a society faces So just like, you know, the Eastern European, the Hungarians facing the Mongols in the 13th century, it's one of those times. And that's what I see as their big threat, is maintaining the real independence. And there will always be people who can say, oh, we can make a deal, or we can work something out. But that's not. But it, that requires the other side to want to work something out, and I don't think they do.
Interesting. Interesting. You wrote a piece that appeared in Asia Times about what the election of Joe Biden means potentially to the Pacific Rim. Let's talk about that. First of all, paint a picture of American relations with the Pacific Rim in the Obama-Biden administration. If you could take us back.
Yeah, it was. I will note that it's even best to take it back to George Bush, H.W. Bush the first. So really, because that's when the appeasement started. The idea that if we accommodate China, give them what they want, don't require them to play by the rules, that they will liberalize, even if they don't want to, they'll have to because their so-called rising middle class will demand more rights, etc. So it started way back when, and the cast of characters to thank for this splendid achievement is both Republican and Democrat, and that needs to be always pointed out. You know, if anyone's interested, George H.W. Bush wrote a letter to Deng, the Chinese leader, right after Tiananmen Square, to basically tell him, hey, no problem that you slaughtered all your people. We can still be friends. That letter is on the internet somewhere. It's easy to find. And I think Mr. Bush had Brent Scowcroft deliver it, his national security guy. And you read this thing, and it will make – it puts a lot of things in context. And it also makes one a little less inclined to blame everything on the Democrats. But you said the Obama-Biden era from about 2008 to 2016 – there was a lot of talk about pivoting to Asia, that America was going to really pay attention, was going to put more forces in the region, was going to really beef up its capabilities to protect its interests. You couldn't say the word, you couldn't even mention China as an adversary. That was a taboo word that, you know, it was a name that could not be uttered, or you would just be in huge trouble if you're the military or the government. And so the so-called pivot, you know, was there really wasn't much substance to it. America kept doing the things that it was doing. And everyone kind of realized that after a point, and particularly locally in the region, that people realized, well, this is all that's coming. And that it kind of demoralized some people on our sides, and people who were inclined towards us, well, they say, well, this is all America's doing. And then you had during this time, there are two big events that happened. One is when the Chinese occupied Philippine maritime territory at Scarborough Shoal in 2012. The Chinese Coast Guard sent ships down there, the Philippine Navy sent its ship, or Philippine Coast Guard. And they both, the U.S. State Department, brokered an agreement that both sides would pull out. One side did, the Philippines, and the Chinese stayed, and they have stayed put ever since. Americans did nothing to back up the Filipinos. And that really was the start of, I think, of demoralization amongst, certainly with the Filipinos, and others noticed it in the region, that America wasn't so reliable. And the Chinese saw, well, the Americans aren't going to do anything. And that is when the island building campaign in the South China Sea really took off. It's when the Chinese effort to really establish de facto control over the South China Sea really took off. And so that event was really important, and it shouldn't be forgotten. And then you had another example of how the Obama administration treated its allies was Thailand had a coup, and they've had like 40 coups in the last 70 years. And the Obama administration went out of its way to humiliate and belittle and even punish the new government. And they even sent an important figure to Thailand, and he made the rounds just as being as rude as you could possibly be to the Thais. So they said, okay, we'll be more friendly with the Chinese. And the Chinese have picked up that opportunity. And Thailand was a very long-standing and good ally. But right. To put it in more context, that when the Thai coup happened and the Americans responded this way, about the same time there was a coup in Egypt, you may remember.
Yes.
The Americans had no problem. The Obama administration had no problem with that coup. So the Thais could obviously compare the two. And they weren't very happy. But so the last bit here is you look at the period, what China was doing, and they were just building up their military, proving its capabilities. And while we weren't really backing up our allies, nor were we really strengthening our position in the region. And kind of here we are. And there was also the idea of engagement for engagement's sake. You know, the idea that if the military, the U.S. and Chinese military engage and do stuff, that will help as well. Well, what the Chinese are as smart as us, and they use the opportunity to see how we do things and get better on that score as well. So all in all, it was an era defined by a calculated unwillingness to take on the People's Republic of China, or to either militarily or economically, or to get ready to do that. And combined with a sort of a mindset of de-escalate whenever the Chinese did something provocative. And you put those two together, and it sort of put us into a hole. The Trump administration came along and tried to get us out of the hole. So that's sort of a long way of sort of putting it. And I'm sure that there's probably a division of people who would tell me I'm an idiot and don't know what I'm talking about. But that's sure how it looked to me.
All right. So to save them the trouble, Grant, you're an idiot and you don't know what you're talking about. Okay. Now that we have that out of the way, the piece that you wrote, well, let me do this first. I have, if you go to the Bush archives, you can find President Bush's diary note, I think the day after the Tiananmen Square event. He wrote this: I talked with Nixon, and he was saying, don't disrupt the relationship. What's happened has been handled badly, and it's deplorable, but take a good look at the long haul. I told him I was not going to recall Ambassador Lilly, and he thought that was good. The reports from China are still crazy. There are rumors that Li Peng has been shot, and rumors that Deng is Deng Xiao. So it would be Deng Xiaoping, right?
Yes.
And rumors that Deng was dead. All of this tells me to be cautious and be calm. And then Bush wrote, he writes this as he sticks the letter in his diary of that he writes to Deng Xiaoping. I was frustrated that the Chinese rebuffed my attempts to talk things out directly. If we couldn't talk to Deng, I decided I would explain by letter how I felt and suggest the possibility of an emissary to try to get the relationship back on track, however gradually. I wanted a letter straight from my heart, so I composed it myself. And this is the letter Grant alluded to. I'll read you the first and last paragraphs. I write this letter with a heavy heart. I wish there was some way to discuss the matter in person, but regrettably, this is not the case. First, I write it with the spirit of genuine friendship. This letter is coming, as I'm sure you know, from one who believes with a passion that good relations between the United States and China are in the fundamental interest of both countries. And then he discusses Tiananmen Square. And then he ends like this. I have thought about asking you to receive a special emissary who could speak with total candor to you, representing my heartfelt convictions on these matters. If you feel such an emissary would be helpful, please let me know, and we will work cooperatively to see that his mission is kept in total confidence. We must not let the aftermath, and this is what Grant was talking about, we must not let the aftermath of the tragic recent events undermine a vital relationship patiently built over the past 17 years. I would, of course, welcome a personal reply to this letter. This matter is too important to be left to our bureaucracies. As I said above, I write with a heavy heart, but I also write with frankness reserved for respected friends. Sincerely, George Bush. And then there's a note below. Within 24 hours, President Bush received a reply from Deng, who accepted his idea of a personal emissary. President Bush chose General Scowcroft as his emissary, was also joined by Secretary of Labor Larry Eagleburger. So that is – but again, George H.W. Bush, his shadow on Chinese policy – long shadow, yes, over Chinese policy.
Yes, and some would, you could even take it back right to the beginning with Nixon, and you know, even Reagan and Carter were selling military giving military technology to the Chinese in an effort to play them off against the Russians and to humor them. So it's been going on a long time. I will note that I was mistaken. General Scowcroft didn't exactly deliver the letter, but he did go to Beijing afterwards.
You bet.
And you know, all these guys, when we talk about this, it is important to remember all these are the guys that are in the ring, and have to try to handle things, and it's never easy, and none of these people are. Yankee rascals, I'm thinking like a guy from Virginia. Most of them are not, I don't know what you call it, at all bad people. They were doing, what they saw their highest sense of right. But at the same time, they kind of got it wrong. And it was obvious 20 years ago they had gotten it wrong. That's what, where one, I think, really fairly criticizes is that we kept with this policy for at least two decades longer than there was any possible justification for. And that's kind of where we are. But that letter from Mr. Bush to Deng Xiaoping, if you're a freedom loving person who can imagine what happened in Tiananmen Square, where they slaughtered 10,000 students or people, Chinese citizens, and to just send a letter like that and say, this is too important. Well, I may have to qualify my expression about these being intelligent people somewhat. But they were, they say it's always helpful to not demonize people, but at the same time, if a mistake's been made, that ought to be highlighted, because it does help explain where we are today. And when you're trying to figure out what to do about it, it does give you some ideas of what not to do. So
let me ask you this, in this broad discussion about China, at what point have we seen enough? Have we collected enough data to know that the direction, the hopes of George H.W. Bush, we've had enough indicators that contradict that path and that course of action. When would you say that we had seen enough, Grant, that even the most prudent would say, yeah, while that was a nice thought, it is certainly not coming to pass? How many years of data did we collect before we should have been able to see that?
Oh, everybody will have their favorite date. I think that by 2005, there was no excuse. You could go even further back. I would say that by the late 90s, that it was apparent that China was out to get us, to use common parlance. And but by certainly the mid-2000s, there was no, you know, you really had to sort of twist your thinking to get around the fact that China meant us harm. And, you know, you can't blame the Chinese for if you've got somebody on the other side of the poker table who's showing you their hand and handing over aces. Well, why not? You can't blame them for taking advantage of the people on the other side of the table. But really, 2005-ish, it was pretty obvious. And in my case, I think it was around 1995, 96. But I been looking at the Chinese since 1980, so kind of had a head start.
Got it. So between 2005 and the election of President Trump, what would you say? We don't want to upset the economic apple cart, and that's what gives rise to my favorite Orrin Hatch quote when President Trump slaps his tariffs on, and when Orrin Hatch says, hey, these tariffs concern me. I'm a free trader. So in that intervening period, somebody like Orrin Hatch, who clearly doesn't have a solid command of math, he believes that the economic relationship between China and the United States is a good one in the state that it existed, which to me is stunning. But that's in that period of time, that's when that grows up, that this economic thing is too important and we will sustain whatever terms China dictates because we're not going to upset that.
There was also, don't forget that at the same time, a powerful movement by America's CEO class, the business leadership, to outsource to China. Outsource anywhere, but particularly to the PRC. That was the place everybody wanted to go. They thought it was what the smart people did, and because you could make stuff cheaper and then export it back. And that is what gutted the Youngstown and Akron and Uniontown, Pennsylvania, those areas, because it was that just malicious murder of this slice of American society. By the, say, America's business class. And once again, that was what the smart people all thought. This is what you do. It's the future. It's economics. So that was going on. And all of these people, of course, personally benefited because you get paid, you get your bonus is bigger if you bump up your return on investment or such like. And that was going on at the same time. In the international relations community, the people who run foreign affairs and academia, think tanks, officialdom, political world, the belief was, and this was the accepted dogma, if we treat China like an enemy, then they will be one. But if we treat them like a friend, they'll be friends. There were people saying that all of this was wrong, all of this was dangerous, both the economic and the sort of the defense diplomatic end of it. And those people were generally ignored, ridiculed, humiliated, punished, take your pick. So it's not like nobody knew it or nobody saw it. And certainly that in that class of people who were doing what I just described, nobody gave two hoots about sort of the American manufacturing workers, the so-called blue-collar types that used to be able to have a pretty nice living. And I think, as I noted in a piece recently, now what these people who sold them out gave these blue-collar types is now it's a choice between working at Walmart or opioid addiction. And that's a little bit glib, but
not much though. No, not much.
That's where I was getting to. Say a little bit glib, but man, I would like to think that anybody who weighs in on U.S. foreign policy towards China, in particular, they should be required to go spend a month living in a Red Roof Inn in Youngstown, Ohio, and hanging out on the streets and see what's going on. But I'll bet you none of them ever have, and none of them even care. It's the so-called flyover country with these deplorables who refuse to learn how to do computer code. You can see I'm a little irked at the moment. That's where we are, and now the challenge is to figure out how to make things better.
So what do you think – give us things to keep our eye on in a Biden administration and, he was vice president for 8 years and will he walk away from – there's a lot of as you say, the president has made – and I think a lot of Americans believe – we've made inroads relative to, the Pacific Rim and our relationship out there, and that the confrontation with China was a long time coming. Give us things that we should watch, because to me, I find it disturbing. I find it disturbing that all the progress, and I was just talking to you like the last time you were on, like, is it me or an intel sharing agreement with India, the Malabar exercise being larger than ever, with rumblings of it being huge next year, with all kinds of other things that you read about, the Philippines beginning to arm their militia ships to enforce their economic exclusion zone, Palau inviting us in. Right. Japanese defense forces, the defense budget going up, military sales to Taiwan, right, in a way we've never seen them. Australia beginning to confront the Chinese. All these things have taken years to get in motion. So give us important things to watch, that if you see this begin to be dismantled, then you're going to see the unraveling of, I think the only course of action, that is the free nations of the world in the Western Pacific and in Asia beginning to act in concert, which is China's worst nightmare, to tell the Chinese, you've got to play by the rules or you will face us collectively. So what say ye to all of that? Give us indicators that you would say would not be in things to watch that would not really bode well for the future.
The one thing, say if the Biden administration does come to pass, and it still has to be certified by our procedures, the way, by our laws. So that's why I do qualify it that way. And is that I'd look at who gets appointed to positions like Secretary of State, National Security Advisor, Defense Department, and also Treasury in as well. And because that'll often give you a sense of how they're going to see things. And that'll be an important thing to look at. And also you'll find that I would note that no party or administration has ever cornered the market on good people, nor has it cornered the market on idiots. There are people on sort of the Biden side who, that side who, are good. But you do have to watch and see who gets in, because they will shape I think, determine the course and the nature of our dealings with China, our strategy towards China. And it really isn't, I think in D.C., there's probably only like 2, 3, or 4 people who are really have decisive authority to shape U.S. policy. So, even if you have some good people below at fairly high positions, say in State Department, Defense Department, etc., if they're not getting the backing from the White House, that they really don't matter that much. So that'll be an important thing to watch, are the appointments to those key positions. Consider what the Americans and our allies are. Look at what we're doing today, and you just rattled off a lot of these. The exercises, the training, the diplomatic engagements that we're having, and the language that's being used. You know, are U.S. officials speaking up for, you know, freedom, rule of law, etc.? Our values, our interests, are they backing up our friends? And watch for that and see if that continues or may even get better. I would expect a different administration to stop trying to make such a big deal out of this squeezing money out of our friends in Japan and South Korea. But that's easily done. And then look at what we're doing on the economic front, and particularly in terms of the sort of reining in Chinese economic aggression. Are we keeping the pressure on the way the Trump administration did? Are we keeping sort of the pressure on the human rights front? Are we putting more sanctions on more Chinese entities, etc.? And also look at what we are doing to bolster our friends, our partners, economically. You know, is there a move afoot to give them a good deal, you know, sort of give them economic preference or benefits in trade, etc. Consider the U.S. Sort of force laydowns or the activities in the region, and consider what they're doing with our friends. You know, how does it look? Does it look like it's just a serious relationship where we can actually operate and fight together, or is it, you know, sort of a rote kind of exercise that we've always done, followed up by a barbecue? You know, trying to get a sense of the nature of what we're actually doing. Are we doing things that the Chinese are going to complain about? That's always a good sign. Or are we backing off? You know, do we stop the ship sailings through the Taiwan Strait? Do we stop going into the South China Sea so often? Look at how our language, our propaganda is used. Is it deferential? You know, is it talking about becoming friends, etc.? Or is it saying, no, we have interests and we're going to stand up for them? So looking at things along those lines, sort of the nature of what's being done, the nature of our relationships with our friends, and see how they're responding as well. And there's going to be China's going to push, and there's going to be problems really soon, and we'll get a good sense of just how, whatever administration it is, you know, just how serious they are about taking on the People's Republic of China. There's going to be something, and probably more than one thing, that requires the whoever's in the White House to really stand up and take some risks. So we should know soon enough.
In terms of China's going to test the new administration at some point, and your prediction is, and it won't simply be one either; it will be multiple events.
Yeah. I would expect, you know, obviously something involving Taiwan. You know, there's that little Taiwanese island that you have to go through sort of Hong Kong airspace to get to. Or you can imagine that what happens if China says, sorry, Taiwan, you can't come by sea or air. We're not going to let you. And if you do, we're going to shoot you. Then what does an administration do? The Chinese fishing fleet really leans in on the Senkaku Islands or down in southern Japan and sends in 300 ships, refuses to leave. When the Japanese Coast Guard comes out, the Chinese Coast Guard faces off with them. And what do you do at that point? On the Indian border, China makes a move. So that's going to be a challenge as well. And so there's people who really follow this stuff. They could probably name 20 possibilities. And right. You never quite know what it's going to be. It's usually something you don't predict. At least in my case, but it's going to be something that isn't directed towards us specifically, but is probably directed towards our friends, our allies, and you know we will have to put up or shut up, you know, if we're you know in that case. But if the effort is to, if the idea is to de-escalate you know, come over, just sort of reach a deal to call it off, you know, and there's shuttle diplomacy, et cetera, to work out an arrangement that if you do that, we've lost because we will have conceded. The Chinese will know that we will concede, and the pressure just continues. It's not like they reciprocate when you do a favor. It'll be an interesting thing to watch what happens. But it does kind of make you sort of long for 20 years ago when things weren't quite so chaotic.
And the Chinese weren't so powerful. Email. Hey, Mac, I'm curious. President Obama was fashioning the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Did Grant view that as a positive step economically, and does he believe that will be reintroduced to discussions in the not too distant future?
Good question. I kind of looked into I remember the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, because I was asked to speak about it once down in Osaka, so I actually had to learn what was going on. And my take was that economically it wasn't necessarily going to be a huge advantage, but politically and psychologically, in terms of American leadership and free nations that had proper legal systems getting together to deal trade with each other, I thought it was immensely important, potentially. So I actually came out in favor of it. It was my thinking. But say the economics of it, if you read the actual deal, and it looks like large parts of it were written by like the pharmaceutical companies or the insurance companies of Wall Street that written for their benefit. So they would have done, I think their interests were protected. Was anyone else's? I'm not so sure. But I thought on the economic end, it may have been something of a wash, but the political significance, I thought it was considerable, and I was disappointed that it didn't go anywhere. But it's worth remembering that the Obama administration did not try to pass it. They, at the end of the day, they sort of lost interest in trying to push it through. And also, Mrs. Clinton refused to. She disavowed it also. But what you have now in terms of restarting it, the American working class has been gutted so much that you almost wonder, well, how much more damage could you do to them? And that was always one of the arguments against it, was that it was going to hurt that blue-collar manufacturing sort of muscular labor class. And I'm being a little cynical, but, you know, exactly how much more harm could be done? And if another administration really sees these people as deplorables, from losers, from flyover country, maybe there is a chance for the TPP, but something like it, I always thought was would have been a good thing. Call it something else, reconfigure it, but something that draws together free nations and gives them an economic advantage, and gives us an economic advantage, from dealing with each other, get off that addiction to the Chinese market. I thought that was a good thing. I still do. Like a lot of things. I think if you just turned it over to the captains and the majors, in a couple of days you'd probably get something really good. But at our sort of ruling class level, goodness knows how long that would take.
All right. What haven't I been smart enough to ask you about your article? The article is entitled, it appears in Asia Times. The link will be in this in the body of the podcast. The headline is that Grant doesn't write, but the headline is Biden restoration cause to rejoice in Beijing. There is no shortage of officials, companies, and Wall Street firms eager to return to pre-Trump softly policies on China. What haven't I been smart enough to ask you either about, let's see, the South China Sea, about signatures on a letter, or the other things you discuss in your article, or the excuses, or the terms of surrender, What haven't I been smart enough to ask you about that stuff?
The article, it was actually written 16 months ago, but it's been and published then. And it was reworked to make it contemporary because when I write stuff, I try to make it so it has a shelf life.
Yes.
That you could actually read it a year later and find it kind of relevant. And this one I thought was. And the thing that I, would hope is that the people who got us into this mess or helped get us into this mess, that you'd hope they've learned their lesson and that they may come back, some of them, and say, what we did before didn't work so well, so we're going to try something else. And maybe some of this stuff that Mr. Trump was doing was pretty good. And maybe they would continue that, partly to not so that they will not be seen as the people who lost China, which they used to use that expression in the 40s. But, the people who really blew it. So you may get them actually purposely behaving and thinking and operating differently than they did when they had their first go-round. In some cases, their second and third go-rounds. But that is maybe how an optimist would look at it, is that, that people who have crashed, if you get a pilot who's crashed his airplane, once or twice and there's been fatalities, but he's miraculously walked away unscathed, and somehow he gets back in the cockpit. He gets his license back. You'd like to think he might be more careful and fly the plane a little better. That is a possibility. It's not, unthinkable. That's what one thing I just wanted to mention. But and like a lot of things, there's an expression, things are never as good as they seem or as bad as they seem. That's one way to look at it. But boy, having watched the China thing for so long, I would like to see what the, how much worse it could be. We'll see, but we'll find out.
Well, I don't think it takes much. I don't think they're what are they looking for? Another letter like George H.W. Bush wrote that says, really, because when you read the letter, to me, when I put the letter down and I look at my national security advisor and my secretary of state, if I'm Deng, I say the United States will do nothing, which gives us a green light, right?
Yes, that's unfortunately is the way to look at it. They did have to be careful because we did have much more power over them back then.
But, at the time, right?
Yeah, but you ask who needed who more in 1989. The answer is clear, and we didn't play our cards right. And we had like 10 aces. That's what they're going to be looking. The Chinese are going to be looking for is this administration out to cut a deal, to sort of split the difference and just let bygones be bygones and start turn over a new leaf, etc. If they see that, if they smell it, then we're in trouble. And through all of this, as we've talk about two out of every three shows, really Wall Street and I would suggest a good chunk of the U.S., the big part of the U.S. Business class. They are just as keen as ever to do business in China. They don't want anything to interrupt that or to prevent them from getting their snouts into that trough. That causes any administration trouble because those people are huge financial supporters of the political parties. They seems like more one party than others these days. And they provide a lot of opposition to an administration that does try to stand up more strongly for the free world interests. It's going to be tough. I think I'm not entirely optimistic about what's coming. Not optimistic at all. But we'll see. There's a tendency for guys who commentate like me to lay out a sequence of events that are going to happen, and while that could happen, it very often things turn out a lot differently. You know, things happen, and so that's always worth remembering, that you can kind of talk yourself into misery if you predict the future a certain way. But stuff happens, and things don't always continue on a trend line or a trajectory. And sometimes it works out better than you think, and then sometimes it doesn't. I think we'll probably won't have to wait a decade to find out which way it's going to go.
Here's an email. Mac, I'm listening to Grant, and I think there's an inertia a lot of times that goes with politics, and that is a new administration seeks to reverse either the tension or the trend line of the past administration. I think doing that in the Pacific Rim would be a very, very grave mistake. I think the one thing that President Biden could do, and you all have talked about it before, is to create economic relationships. And even if it is in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, that would bring us closer economically to the Philippines, Vietnam, Indonesia, Malaysia, India, Australia, and dare I say, even Japan. Those would be the foundation of expanded military ties. I think he could do that, and it would add to what is currently underway in the Pacific. If we turn back from this, to me, it opens the door for China to further usurp the rules-based order of the post-World War II world, and I believe it would be a serious and grave mistake. Grant, what say you to that little bit of eloquence?
I've been I was writing it all down, and that's my next article. I will take full credit. Grant Frederick Newsham. It says it. You know, guys like me, at least, we tend to, you know, I understand the economic angle of it, you know, certainly pretty well, but we tend to not to give it the attention it deserves. And our economic capabilities, the things we offer, and the things that we can get our friends in with, the Japanese, you know, even some of the South Koreans, the Taiwanese, Australians, you know, that if we use our economic capabilities to really create friends and reward friends who, you know, want to be free, that it really does translate itself into the military side of things. They tend to be mutually reinforcing,
right?
But you've got to really pay attention to the economic end of it. And a friend of mine in government a couple of years ago maybe, we're talking about this, and he's in the game. He said, you know, that we're putting these tariffs on China, but we're also putting them on our friends at the same time. It's sort of a blanket tariff. And he said there's actually been like American diplomats who've gone to these countries that have gotten hit, and as well as, and the Americans have actually said something to the effect, well, you know, you should be glad to pay it because we're taking on the Chinese for you. You know, that isn't how it works. It's more, you know, we're going to take on the Chinese, but we're going to give for you, my friend, very cheap, very nice. We have a, you know, we've got a good deal for you. I mean, like, right. Even I could figure that out. And but can you imagine? I asked him, how on earth could an American actually say that with a straight face? And he sort of, you know, shrugged his shoulders and smirked. And yeah, so there were some things which we didn't help ourselves with. But the economic angle really is as important as anything else. You know, and you find us, you know, we're always saying, don't do business with the Chinese, don't do business, you know, cut them off. But those other countries fairly ask, well, what's the alternative? And you really see this in the small Pacific Island nations where there's nothing else going. And if the Chinese are there with money, promising more money, and there's no alternative to that, well, why wouldn't they accept it? If I was able to write fast enough, I would have probably taken down every word of that email and used it my own piece. I think it states it nicely.
Very nice. All right, what are you writing next? What's next on the? Who's next on the hit list?
Oh,
now that now, hey, hold it. President Donald J. Trump fired the Secretary of Defense Mark Esper moments ago. So there you have it.
Yeah, I'm going to try to write something. I don't know if you call it constructive, but everything I write, I try to say, well, this is what we can do to make it better. So I'm going to try and write something along those lines about what's coming or what our opportunities are. And it may take, it may take a while to write it, but I think that's what I'd like to point out, because and I used that line earlier, that I don't think any administration has cornered the market on good people or on bad people. So that's, and sometimes you just need a few of the right people in the right places. And that's what I'm, going to try. Probably maybe something along those lines.
Got it. What is, so we're entering into winter here in the United States. What part of the seasonal year are you in the Western Pacific?
Well, winter, but it's not like winter in Jersey. yeah. Or, winter in TBS, November in TBS. It isn't that cold.
Got it. All right. Do they celebrate Thanksgiving?
No.
Oh.
Nobody eats turkey outside of
the United States.
The United States.
And we are emotionally attached to it, I might add. So it's not like it's...
We should be.
It's negotiable. All right, sir. First of all, interesting times we live in. And
yes.
We will see. I do believe per that email that, the reinvigoration of economic relations, which would allow the president-elect to put his hand on it, but without taking his foot off the gas with, I think, all the other positive things, and really that are emblematic of the free nations of the world in the Pacific acting in concert, which is, to me, what you really have to have no matter what else happens, is you have to have them hang together or they will surely hang separately. So, anyway. All right, Grant. Have a good night. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks a lot. Always enjoy it.
You bet. That is Grant Newsham. You know what? Always wonderful when the people that write in can contribute to Grant's next column. That's absolutely wonderful. And that's not the first time, honestly. Grant will tell you, some of the emails that you receive are become the seeds of future articles. So my thanks to him on this ninth day of November. So that will do it here on a Monday. If you're tuning in right now, you'll hear my uncle passed away, and my uncle Muggs. I have some thoughts about him, what a wonderful man he was, and you'll hear about that. I also had a great weekend with, Friday, I did post-traumatic winning at Camp Pendleton with the Marines from 3rd Battalion, 5th Marines. So I'm fired up about that, and did post-traumatic winning with two of the companies from 3-5. So, and then became an honorary member of Kilo Company 3-5. Boom, that's right. Which is important because my son Patrick's a member of 3-5. So now that I'm a no-shit honorary member of Kilo Company, that makes me legit, right? We're Kilo bros, which he will not accept. But it doesn't matter. He doesn't decide that. That's right. So, no, I had a couple of Marines up for dinner on Saturday. And honestly, my life is sometimes I have to pinch myself because of all the good things that happen. And post-traumatic winning tends to be at the center of all of that. So, anyway, have a great Monday on the eve of the 245th birthday of the Marine Corps. Yeah. Can't say it yet because it's not our birthday, but I will tomorrow. So have a great day. Don't be afraid to change somebody's life on a Monday. All Marine Radio. Out.